Florence, Italy, 1798. The Collector. The collector, wearing an oilcloth hat, overcoat, and soaking wet boots, slogged through rain, a fish-shaped basket of gray willow sealed by a flap of leather across his shoulders. Shifting and reshifting his miserable weight, he dodged his way through an alley cobbled in the dark Pietra Serena of Florence onto Via Romana, a short distance from the museum's anatomy studio. He had found her corpse, stays wrongly laced, skirt unfastened, hair undone, heeled against a wall beneath the shadowed portico of Ospedale di Santa Maria Nuova. And because he knew her, he had at first turned away. In the hospital's morgue, stripping off the familiar clothes, he grasped her damp hip-length hair, still smelling of olive wood smoke, in both his hands. Surprised by the quick hardening of his cock, he bent down, sucked each of her cold, rosy tan nipples, pressed one ear against her chest as if he might hear something, floated his hand between her chill white legs, dived his fingers into the black crevice that signified love. A despicable act suggested itself to him. Instead, he opened the willow basket and in an almost refined manner laid her in it, tied down the leather flap. She was small, and this new weight of her, stony, slack, saddened him. Better than anyone, the collector knew the brevity and meanness of her future. Flesh sold to the museum's anatomy studio, limbs severed, torso flayed, select parts used for plaster and wax casts. When the dissectionists and artists were finished, he would shoulder her a second time, butcher's offal, to be tumbled into a communal pit for paupers, prostitutes, foreigners, criminals, beggars, a hellish tangle of the lost and rebuked. And in some perverse reciprocity, money he had given her for sex would be repaid him now by her corpse. This grand book, The Universe, is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one wanders about in a dark labyrinth. Galileo Galilei. The director. The director noted unhappily that the museum's collector, Il Cinzio, had delivered a fresh cadaver to his dissection table, along with a registered receipt, at the bottom of which was a line of ink awaiting his peevish signature. The corpse, already turning a faint verdigris, had no further use for time or weather, while for him, warm temperatures, excessive rain, or lives wasted on debauchery and religion were arch-enemies of science. A short, insatiable man, energized by intellectual vanity, at war with his own obsessions, ex-abbot Felice Fontana of Rovereto, anatomist, physicist, chemist, former logician at the University of Pisa, now director of the Imperial and Royal Museum for Physics and Natural History, bit into the leathery skin of a dried fig dipped into a mix of wild thyme honey and bee pollen. The girl looked scarcely 18, unmarked, although the starry dots on her nipples, like nebulae with faint blue rings around them, indicated an early stage of pregnancy. Her pudenda, slightly swollen, were anatomically marvelous. But suddenly he was sick of eating supper off the same scarred table he performed his bloody dissections on. Lately, he found he cared for only three things: his hives of Italian honeybees, the creation of a giant anatomical man of pine, and deciphering before he died the hexagonal codes of the universe. And to a lesser degree, he was interested in the subtle emotional pressures of architectural space, and had read just that morning an intriguing article about a certain grand ice palace constructed half a century before in St. Petersburg. Soon after being appointed court physician and museum director by Grand Duke Pietro Leopoldo, Felice Fontana had acted upon his own notions of liberty and confinement by flinging open sections of the museum to public scrutiny. By a maze of interconnecting rooms, he intended to expose what he considered to be the unrelievedly ugly, profane, secret interior of the human body. Beginning with a deceptively placid anteroom of wax skeletons, the visitor was shunted through increasingly morbid, gaudy exhibits of human musculature, tendons, sinews, nerves, and ligatures. The human body, peeled back upon itself, layer by layer, until he entered as if into a four-sided womb, the gynecological exhibit, then exited the labyrinth through a claustrophobic chamber of apocalyptic dioramas by Sicilian wax artist Gaetano Zumbo, entitled Pestilence, Corruption of the Flesh, The Triumph of Time, and The Gallic Disease. Lower classes, if cleanly dressed, were admitted to the museum's public exhibits from 8 until 10 o'clock in the morning. Ignorant riffraff, greedy and daft, they galloped straight to the gynecological and Zumbo horror showrooms to gawk at sex organs, nudity, gruesome depictions of disease and decay, and the whole abyss of reproduction. Educated nobler classes, arriving by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, shared the prurience of the lower classes, but tempered their lust and morbidity by proceeding sedately through the labyrinth, pausing as if genuinely interested and intrigued before skeletons and flayed men, lingering in front of the endless cabinets of sense organs, cavities of thorax, abdomens, pelvises, gaping stomachs, each a repugnant rebuttal in Fontana's view to his hexagonic ideal. The sweetness of the dried fig, the crunch from its seeds, tiny and pale as the white spray of dots on the dead girl's nipples, dissolved on his tongue as he stared absently at her, past her. A man who failed to appreciate his own achievements. Fontana was obstinately preoccupied with his most elusive legacy, a man-giant carved of pine whose wooden internal organs and viscera could, by ingenious design, be lifted out and studied by future generations of medical students. To replace raw, malodorous meat with solid, clean-grained geometry, to establish a theology of order based on nature's universal code. His failure to do either of these haunted and nearly depressed him. He lived alone in a compact, stylish villa near the museum, steps from the Palazzo Pitti, where he tended his clay tile beehives, harvesting raw medicinal honey and a superior wax for the museum's anatomies. Unsuccessfully schooled for the priesthood and known to don ecclesiastical robes on certain cynical occasions, Fontana was unrelentingly hostile to Catholic doctrine. Ultimately, he insisted, a man's art and end had nothing to do with his theology. Only science, reason herself, could award humanity the gift or poison of immortality. Still, his most gifted anatomist, Clemente Susini, a wreck of a man who insisted on living in a state of perpetual genuflection, would no doubt find this arrival of this flawless corpse, this rare girl, fortunate. Anatomy is, so to speak, the foundation of natural theology, 18th century encyclopedia. The anatomist. The anatomist knelt before the female cadaver, letting all 59 beads of the rosary slip, one by one, in decades of 10, through his fingers as he prayed, Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, each bead a human vertebra. The crucifix itself, said to be taken from the breastbone of an uncanonized saint from Naples. Three of his sons had died of lung disease, and now his fourth boy, the youngest, Angiolo, had begun coughing blood. Clemente Cesini no longer remembered when he had begun seeing men and women inside out, without their drab cloaks of skin. He was intimate with the glittering casket of jewels concealed within, the gem sheen of organs, the ivory of bone, ruby of blood and muscle, lapis lazuli of arteries and veins, the pale gold nettings of lymph, sealed inside envelopes of blankness, plainness. Each body a reliquary packed with soft-cut bijouterie. Yet the French portraitist, Madame Vigie Lebrun, who had painted numerous portraits of Marie Antoinette, once visited the museum's anatomy studios and upon her return to Paris wrote a letter addressed to Cesini, stating that the visit had ruined her. Whenever she attempted to paint a nobleman or woman, a prince or princess, all she could see now were veins, blood, organs, bones, flesh, and fat. Since Madame Vigie Lebrun's letter of flirtatious complaint, the French queen had lost her head, and Cesini knew exactly what the inside of the queen's head looked like. They were all the same. Her executioner had the same stuff inside his skull as had the queen. A cryptic revolution lay in such divine democracy. Too bad, he supposed, that the portraitist could no longer see people from their embellished outsides, arranged and posed, wigged and powdered and draped, beside lean greyhounds, with silver bowls of sugared fruit and bolts of Chinese silk. Madame Vigie Lebrun, nauseated by such, quote, disgusting slop, unquote, became equally horrified whenever she remembered that all this mess pulsed inside of her, too. At such times, her famous brush would halt in midair, and as often as not, she wrote to him, she would faint dead away. What did he suggest for a cure? Ridiculous, he had thought, burning her letter as answer, this spoilt, profane woman with her fashionable Parisian viscera. The tasks endured by the petitioner have been unspeakable, for beside the continued handling of the dead bodies, he has found himself on many occasions without sufficient time to get something to eat in order to attend to his unceasing work, petition on behalf of Il Cinzio, trash collector for the Imperial and Royal Museums. The collector. The collector, done with his raw bacon and bread, his goatskin flask drained of a red wine so burning and thin as to resemble vinegar, lay sprawled snout up and snoring near the cypress-wooded edge of the mass grave. A man of impressive height and girth, of a near legendary strength said to be gotten from carrying cadavers, he was a pariah. No one ate with him or spoke to him. Even the cheapest women shunned him. After she had arrived from Milan, ill, hungry, not knowing who he was, the girl had let him pay her, had coughed and spat blood on his filthy shirt, stain of it still there, a dark red poppy stem. Swaddled in his damp overcoat, his soaked boots loosed from his long knobbed feet, he slept not two lengths from the earth vat where she now lay in rough bits, scattered like coarse seasoning, herbs of lymph and ligature, tendon and bone, strewn over the others, all turning to grave soil, their wormy whiteness lending luster to the soldierly black cypress nearby. Two nights later, upright but sluggish, his limbs heavy as iron-grained wood, the gray nut-meat in his head a roar of pain, Il Cinzio zigzagged his way down the cobbled streets, a new corpse straddled across his back. Since tumbling her parts into the mass grave, he'd eaten nothing, drunk nothing, but cheap wine dregs, and now he staggered under this newest sack and slosh of bones and viscera cloaking his shoulders. Taking a shortcut through the Giardino di Boboli, stopping to rest beside the green Turkish-style coffee house, the hump on his back a vestigial rot twin. Il Cinzio picked and stubbed his way down a steep gravel path to the back entrance of the museum, turning down a familiar dark passageway, passing the carpentry shop, the glazery. He stopped short when he felt, thought he felt, a small shudder across his back, and in a fury flung the basket to the black and white patterned floor, kicking at the leather and willow to make certain dead was dead. Then looking up, he spied a thread of light coming from one of the studios and, dumping his hideous still life on Felice Fontana's table, plunged down the hall in as straight a line as his anvil-limbed body could allow toward the thin seam of light. Clemente Susini, wearing a black frock coat scoured with age, a shirt with a limp ruffle and a filthy cravat, stood with Il Cinzio over the pale, recumbent figure, a bank of guttering beeswax tapers illuminating all three of them. Lo Spoletto. She stared open-eyed into some mysterious distance, his whore, lips parted, chin tilted to one side, her expression rapturous. Her arms lay at her sides, the knee of her right leg raised, slightly bent, and suggestively open. He recognized the pubic hair as hers. She looked vital, replete with the little death of sex. And for the second time, not in front of her sad corpse this time, but before her flawless effigy, he felt his fool of a cock stiffen. Do you remember bringing her to us? How beautiful she is. With his tapering white hands, anatomists from their handling of the dead were said to have the finest hands, hands that never aged. Then why were his, Il Cinzio, so besmirched and so misshapen? Suzini took hold of two white silk tabs on either side of the wax-smooth ivory abdomen, and as if it were a common kettle lid, raised the shell of her stomach. Revealed a still, particolored, livid cosmos of entrails, stomach, liver, duodenum, heart, kidneys, lungs, glands, and further down, pegged into the scarlet, narrow-necked basin of her pear-halved womb, curled on its side of less size than a man's thumb, a seed child, attached to its mother's body by an anguine cord of ochre, amber, and green. Reluctantly, Suzini settled the soft white armor of her stomach back in place, and with Ilcinzio's help, set a rosewood and crystal case over her. She was entombed in glass, canonized but for her nakedness, a single wanton strand of pearls around her clean, full neck, a neck made from the honeycomb of bees. Ilcinzio recalled her live, yielding flesh. The real child, his perhaps, plugged into her womb, a rotting fig. Looking at the wax replica, he felt his own life ending, at an end, and desired nothing more. No one is free who has not obtained the empire of himself, Pythagoras. The director felt happiest these days, eating honeycomb, its tiny hexagons fragrant with lavender and wild thyme, settled among his books, reading the Swiss polymath Albrecht von Haller's anatomical atlas, Iconis Anatomicae, reflecting on von Haller's theory that anatomy and physiology were linked, thus forming a living anatomy, anatomia animate. Poring over von Haller's accounts of dissections using injection and extirpation, Fontana concurred with his theory of irritability based upon human and animal experimentation. Irritability had been proven to be a property of muscle fiber and sensibility a property of nervous fiber. Muscle fiber demonstrated distinct irritability by contracting under the stimulus of pain, while nervous fiber under the same stimulus demonstrated sensibility or feeling. The pulsating heart was the most irritable organ of the body, and all organs, thus the totality of what was called human, operated independently of transcendental ideal or religious soul, life, a fixed detente between anarchy and order, vitalism and entropy. This idea satisfied him. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body, St. Paul. The anatomist made his way through dull, lashing rain to his tiny neighborhood church, Santa Margherita de Cerchi. Mass after mass, he shamelessly bargained with the Virgin. If she spared his only living son, Angiolo, he would dedicate his finest works to her. He had lost count of how many wax infant Jesus figures he had fashioned for the churches of Florence. He rarely bothered signing them, but the wax queen, Regina Cera, was his praise song to the Virgin. An alchemical remixing of the substance of a street prostitute into pure effigy, like the mystery of incarnation itself. And the bud of life he had found, cutting into the dead girl's belly, was it not like the doomed, mild infant he'd been faithfully creating and recreating, the child of God, the child of sin, the same? The collector before his death, had loathed Paolo Mescagni, the young artist from Pisa, who, auditioning for the coveted but unpaid position of apprentice anatomist, startled everyone by unveiling with an arrogant flourish a life-sized wax figure of Ilcinzio the collector, whose body had been found in the public cemetery lost to drink, foul weather, and the brute, swampy errors of his life. Mescagni, hoping to gain favor with Felice Fontana, had crafted from the giant, well-muscled cadaver a vertical gentleman of wit, rakish, one arm raised as if to tip an invisible hat, a skinless dandy, one leg thrust out in mid-stride, heading nowhere. Paolo Mescagni of Pisa was grudgingly awarded the position he sought, and within days was given his first assignment. Using one of the museum's newest microscopes from Paris, He was ordered by Fontana as a curb to his pride to dissect and reproduce in colored wax the speckled stomach of Helix aspera, the common land snail. The director collapsed in the street outside his villa on an unusually hot spring morning. He would die hours later of a brain hemorrhage cradled in the sycophantic embrace of Paolo Mascagni, who would briefly and disgracefully succeed him as director. In the final moments of his life, Felice Fontana's thready filaments of thought were not of his colossal unfinished mistake, the man of wood. Instead, he considered what a buffoonish figure Napoleon Bonaparte, after conquering Florence, had turned out to be. Le petit corporal, bandy-legged, dwarfish, reeking of black licorice, strutting in pompously high mud-caked boots through Fontana's labyrinth of wax specimens, and showing only the most puerile interest in Susini's naked Venus, making crude jokes about her glued-on pubic hair, before becoming fascinated by the soft darts and limp arrows of flayed penises aimed uselessly at her recumbent figure from the west side of the room. Napoleon, his saffron-colored gloved hands clasped behind his thick back, leaned close to examine the largest penis, a slug-like flaccid stalk that some wag had tied a violet-striped gross-grain bow around the neck of. "Why?" he asked, straightening up. "Why does that one wear a war decoration?" The emperor would redeem himself only slightly by ordering an entire set of full-figure anatomies to be sent to his military hospital in Paris, blatantly competing with the Austrian emperor whose sister he had married. As Fontana reclined in his false heir's arms, his brain, that penultimate irritability, gave off dying impressions like dreams. Leaking old disorderly blood, it led him into Empress Anna Ivanovna's ice palace, built 65 years before in St. Petersburg. This niece of Peter the Great had hired an architect, George Kraft, to cut great blocks of ice, sprayed with water that then froze, acting as cement, to construct a castle 52 feet long, ringed by a balustrade, its roofline crowned by a series of statues. The windows were framed, the exterior walls tinted to resemble marble. Inside was a bedroom with a bed of ice, an ice vanity, an ice fireplace with iced logs, a dining room with a clock whose inner workings were of ice, and beside the clock, an ice cabinet filled with ice dishes. At night, candles were lit, and the palace glowed from the inside, while outside, ice cannons were fired to amuse the people, and near the cannons were ice dolphins and ice elephants, acting as fountains by day and torches by night. The elephant could cry out like a living creature because of a man hidden inside, equipped with a brass horn. Inside the palace, which endured 3 months, a wedding took place. The guests were jesters and cripples, and the couple, elderly Prince Galitzin, who had offended the Empress, and his bride, a terrified Kalmuk girl, spent their wedding night shivering in their ice bed with its ice pillows and ice mattress. 1 year later, when the Empress died, she would be lowered into her own chthonic palace of Russian dirt, watched over by an Eastern orthodoxy of worms. In its last mordant parse of logic, Felice Fontana's dimming brain, the distinguished guest of itself, toured the Empress's Baroque castle of ice, marveling at its infinite crystalline structures of ice, which, like the honeycomb, were hexagonal. The ice crystals humming in his brain first turned into long-waisted bees making propolis, then into his own black and gold-striped Italian bees bearding during the rising of the Pleiades, when 7 stars hung in the constellation of Taurus, and in a sudden, swift unspooling of all logic, Fontana watched floating remnants of geometry theorems resemble and reassemble into an ice hexagon, the hexagon, an expression of Venus, whose sacred number was 6, the dual triple goddess, which then dissolved into Plato's doctrine of the transmigration of souls, which, among other things, stated that the souls of people most solitary and quiet during their span of days on earth were changed as if by magic into honeybees. The anatomist. The anatomist, dizzy, out of breath, his hands and feet going numb from the effects of the mercury he had absorbed from his studio chemicals, ruined by dampness and odors, by overwork and a sickness of grief for his son, hovered near the center of the bridge, in no hurry to go home, gazing down into the rain-swollen river, mistaking it for the green-blue boiling wax he had used for her Venus system. The Virgin had not seen fit to honor his prayers. Angiolo had died, and he, Clemente Susini, was destroyed in health and hope. But that was not why his body would be found the next morning beneath the bridge, drowned in a marsh of yellow mud. Susini, dying of mercury poisoning, had merely leaned too far over the side of the wooden bridge to better see her blessed face, veiled by dark water, and to better hear what enigmatic instruction she was giving him, and so lost his balance and tumbled ingenious prayer into the cool answer of her arms. Fairy tale. Late at night, every night, when the long silent halls and rooms, the labyrinths of the Imperial Museum, were neither lit nor attended by living souls, an hour came when Il Cincio, lifting his imaginary hat a little higher, raising his leg a little farther, stepped off his white and gilt circular stand and made his way the short distance to room 28, to display cabinet number 740, to her silken bed, where she lay naked, forever turning her eyes to gaze with an overpowering sweetness upon him. And having once been a man of unusual strength, it did not take much for him to raise the crystal and rosewood cover, extend one flayed hand to help her to sit, to stand, to walk from place to place, from room to room, from garden to garden, and rule the world a while with him. Myth. Felice Fontana, ex-abbot, director of the Imperial and Royal Museum of Physics and Natural History, a reclusive scientist, known on occasion to wear in a gesture of sarcasm his ecclesiastical robes, was buried in the Church of Santa Croce alongside the bodies of Michelangelo, Galileo, Rossini, and other famous Italians. The next day, when a solitary honeybee was discovered stumbling along the windowsill of the former director's anatomy studio, a young apprentice, recently arrived from Assisi, flung open the window so the honeybee could find its way, drifting on spring winds, toward the Giardino di Boboli, past the green coffee house, vanishing into the Cistercian monk's herb garden, where a plot of French lavender, having survived a late frost, was setting forth its first violet-spiked bloom. Miracle. By the mid-19th century, religious art scholars agreed that no less than 6 of the 42 wax infant Jesus figures existing throughout the city's churches had been falsely attributed to Clemente Susini. But one wax icon bearing his signature could be found in a shadowy niche of Santa Margherita de' Cerchi, an infant Jesus held in the Holy Mother's arms, said to sometimes turn his head slightly, and wherever the infant's mild blue gaze would alight on whatever person kneeling unaware, all illness would be cured. The Susini effect was commonest in male children, and although these miracles were formally repudiated by the church, to those who were healed, the miracle of Susini's Jesus was cause for salvific, if unsanctioned, joy.